Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC Radio. I'm Jamie Floyd, filling in for Brian Lehrer. Next, we take a look at a new report about voter disenfranchisement from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. The report is called Jim Crow in New York and says today's voting laws for convicted felons have deep roots in racism, not always associated with our northern state. We're joined by Erica Wood, attorney and co-author of the report, and Glenn Martin, vice president of policy and advocacy for the Fortune Society, a nonprofit that helps formerly incarcerated men and women transition back into their communities. Erica Wood and Glenn Martin, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having us on.
So, for those who don't know, what are the voting laws for convicted felons in New York State?
So the law in New York State is that you are convicted of a felony, you lose the right to vote while you're in prison and during the time that you're on parole, even if you're living in the community. So people on probation never lose the right to vote. People on parole do.
So let's be as clear as we can. Once you've served your time and you're released from prison, now you're living on parole, you still cannot vote.
That's right. And people live in the community for many, many years. They're working, they're raising their families, but they cannot vote in New York State.
All right, so let's talk about numbers. Let's say we're talking about 100,000 adults in New York State. How many of these are black or Latino people? What percentage?
Right. So currently in New York, about 80% of those who are disenfranchised in our state are black and Latino.
So these are some very concrete numbers when we're talking about the number of people who are disenfranchised, not able to vote in our state of New York.
That's right.
You write in the report that the current disenfranchisement laws are nearly identical to the rules put in place nearly 140 years ago. And that those rules were intended to keep minorities, people of color, from voting. How and why are our laws here today still, in your view, so influenced by what we used to call, or I guess we still should call, Jim Crow?
That's right. I think a lot of people think Jim Crow only lived in the South, but our sort of careful reading of the New York State Constitution and its history here in New York makes it very clear that Jim Crow lived right here in New York, and that laws that were intended to keep African Americans from voting or that were 140 years ago are still on the books here today. So originally, the franchise were limited to what they called free men. So, you know, slavery obviously disenfranchised African Americans for a long time. And at the time that emancipation happened in New York State, around 1817, there were several constitutional conventions pulled together to try to figure out what to do with the franchise. And we trace those conventions in our report, and we actually have excerpts from the debates at those conventions. Mm. And the rhetoric that was used is actually pretty astounding. But what the delegates decided to do is put two franchise rules into the Constitution, one that limited the franchise to property owners and actually put a property requirement directly on African Americans, exclusively on African Americans. And the other piece that they did is they put in place this criminal disenfranchisement provision that disenfranchised those convicted of infamous crimes.
And what has happened to the property requirement?
So the 15th Amendment came around. There was a civil war. There was a
fast forward through American history.
That's right. But for literally 100 years, there was this. And New York was the only state in the country that had a property requirement exclusively and only for blacks. So whites could vote no matter what, but blacks had to have a minimum property requirement in order to vote. So fast forward through the Civil War and period of Reconstruction and the 15th Amendment, and that it was really the 15th Amendment that forced New York to remove that nefarious property requirement from its constitution. Because New York had targeted that property requirement explicitly on African Americans, the 15th Amendment required them to remove that. At the time that New York removed that property requirement, there was all this debate in the constitutional conventions among the delegates, really tracing the number of African Americans who are in jails and prisons throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that they actually look at the numbers, and the quotes are in the report, look to your penitentiaries and almshouses and who is the population that is there. Mm-hmm. So at that time, they took what was the criminal disenfranchisement provision in the Constitution and made it mandatory throughout the state.
And I want our listeners to get in on this, so let me remind them that they can call in, of course, if they have an opinion on this, but mostly if they or someone they know have been affected by New York's voting laws for convicted felons. Should the laws be changed? Do you think they're appropriate? Give us a call, 212-433-WMYC, 212-433-9692, or leave a comment on our website, WMYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Jamie Floyd filling in for Brian. Glenn Martin, let me turn to you. You help people with criminal records reintegrate into our society, into their community. How do you feel that the voting law is an important part of that? Do you feel that it personally impacts a formerly incarcerated person not to be able to vote? Why is that an important part of reintegrating with one's community?
Sure. We serve about 3,000 people per year at the Fortune Society, people who've been involved in the criminal justice system. And our population that we serve mirrors the criminal justice population here in New York. So over 80% of people that come through our doors are people of color, blacks and Latinos. And essentially what we try to do is provide them with housing, employment, education, all the services needed to help them reintegrate successfully. And all of those things are critically important in terms of reducing recidivism and reducing crime. However, a big part of what we do is to try to reconnect people to their communities. And we're not talking about communities all over New York City, to be quite honest. There are 7 communities that are specifically impacted by the criminal justice system in New York: Harlem, South Bronx, East New York, Brownsville, and so on. So there are communities that are disproportionately impacted by this issue.
Targeted communities.
Absolutely, targeted by the criminal justice system. And what we found is that the more you can do to connect a person back to their community as opposed to the marginalization that happens with the voter disfranchisement law, is the better chance you have of a person not recidivating. When people have a sense of ownership in the community, when they have a sense of belonging, being part of the collective, if you will, the chances of recidivism are considerably reduced.
Which gets me thinking about the effect over time on communities, from father to son to grandson, or I guess it could be mother to daughter to granddaughter. What's the impact, if any? And I'll ask you this question, Glenn, and maybe you don't think there is one, but if a son doesn't see his father vote, do you think there is an effect over time in these communities?
I think there's a huge effect. As a person who did time in prison myself, I did 6 years in prison in New York State before starting to do this work about 9 years ago. And I remember meeting grandfather, father, and son within the same correctional facility upstate New York. And absolutely, there's a cyclical effect. And that applies to employment and a bunch of other areas of life. But the voting piece, you're correct. If the son does not see the father engaged in the voting process, there's less value put on that process. What we've learned at the Fortune Society is that initially when people come through our doors, we ask every single person that comes through the door whether or not they're registered to vote or not, whether they've applied for what's called a certificate of relief from disability to hopefully regain their right to vote from New York State. And then we engage them in the value of exercising their vote. And there are many people who start out saying, well, you know, my vote is not going to be worth anything, so why should I bother? And our initial response to that is, well, there must be some importance to the vote because they took it away from you, right? Why would there be such an effort to take the vote away if the vote did not have value?
What do we say, though, to listeners who may, and I know they're out there, say, well, we didn't take it, you gave it up?
Yeah, I think you have... I mean, my response to that is, even if you take a very, very practical approach to this, again, if you want to see a reduction in crime, an increase in public safety, and you know that there's value to reconnecting people to their community, to their elected officials, to decision-making and so on, why wouldn't you allow a person to have the right back to vote so that you can help to reduce crime and increase public safety?
Erica, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, we have a criminal justice system that determines when someone is ready to leave prison and come back into the community, and that's their job. We have a parole board, we have a division of parole, and their decision is, you know, their job is to decide who's ready to come back into the community, and we need to trust them to make that decision. And once they've decided that someone has rehabilitated themselves and is ready to come back, then that person is back in the community as a citizen.
Fully enfranchised.
That's right.
All right, let's take a call from John in Bergen County, New Jersey, but who has a point of view and a personal one on this subject. John, you're on WMYC.
Hi. Good to be here. Enjoy the show. My brother was actually locked up for 4 years, and when he got out, his rights was removed for while he was on probation. And once he actually got it back, he immediately voted. It was in time for the Obama election. So I think that that's one of those rights that shouldn't be removed regardless. I think as long as you're on the streets, you should have the right to vote.
So you don't agree with the New York rule, the New York law, that for a time during parole, you still cannot vote?
I disagree with that. I think that if people are involved, you know, I think that it's purposely done so that people don't get involved in local elections as far as, like, some counties you vote in the sheriff and district attorney. So I think that, you know, if you could remove people from the process, you know, community have less control on who's in power.
Erica, let me turn to you on this. It sounds as though John's brother was able to vote once paroled. How unique is the New York statute on this?
So this law is different state by state. There's really a patchwork. And on our website, BrennanCenter.org, there's actually a map, and you can see what the law is in different states. But there is a patchwork across the country, and that's part adds to confusion about who knows whether they have the right to vote. And there's confusion among election officials that we've actually documented across the country about there's no sort of cross information between criminal justice system and the election system. And so there's a lot of confusion about who it is and isn't eligible to vote. The law in New Jersey is you are actually disenfranchised on probation and on parole, while across the river in New York, you can vote while on probation, but not while on parole. And in Pennsylvania, you can vote as soon as you're out of prison. So just to give you a little snapshot of how different these laws are state by state.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC Radio. I'm Jamie Floyd filling in for Brian. We're talking about New York voting laws for the formerly incarcerated with Erica Wood from the Brennan Center for Justice and Glenn Martin from the Fortune Society. Glenn, what is the experience like for a convicted felon who does eventually have the right to vote restored?
Mm-hmm. I think I can probably best tell that through a story. One of our staff members, half of our staff members, we have about 190 people on staff, half of them are formerly incarcerated. Some used to actually be clients of the Fortune Society. And one individual came to me. Many people come to me asking for assistance with parole, and he came to me and was working on early release from parole. In New York State, there are certain provisions that allow people to be released from parole early. And he kept pushing me to get in touch with parole and see if he could help move forward the process because he had been on parole for over 4 years successfully. And I remember one day when I finally helped him get the paperwork done into Albany to get released from parole, I said to him, well, you know, why was there such a hard push? And usually the response would be, you know, I'm just tired of being under supervision. I want to move to a different borough, those sorts of things. And it was in the middle of the presidential election where President Obama was running for office. And he said, you know what, I want to vote. I want to be involved in the voting process. And you know, it just sort of, it really made me think, right? Out of all the reasons this individual could have wanted to be off of parole, he said it's because he really wanted to engage in the voting process. And the thing is, we've put way too many people in prison for way too long here in New York and in many other states. And we have some people who have lifetime parole who may never get off of parole and who may be living in the community, doing the right thing, paying taxes and so on, and never able to engage in the voting process.
And we heard the similar comment from Bob, who called to say that his brother really wanted to vote in that Obama election, and it was important to him to have that opportunity. We also have a comment here in chat from another Bob. The question is whether disenfranchisement is part of a mix of appropriate punishment for those who violate the laws of our society. Frankly, more important is whether a felon demonstrates the ability to live lawfully within the community, not whether the community owes the felon something. But we may have a dissenting opinion. Let's take a call. This is Alex in Manhattan. Alex, you're on WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. I think my view was that while voting might be an important aspect of it, it is very low on the list of things that need to get done to fully integrate somebody back into a community, especially after prison and parole. It's one of those things that should be behind getting a job, you know, just getting more integrated in the community, knowing what's going on in the community. And it seems to me to be something that other people are pushing for political reasons, for their own, I won't say nefarious political reasons, but for their own political reasons, and that doesn't necessarily help that person in a very tangible way.
Alex, what about the issue of disenfranchisement? And I hear what you're saying on the question of the politicization of the issue. But what about the larger question that the study points up at BrennanCenter.org, if you want to take a look after the call, of disenfranchising an entire population of people, as opposed to your point, which is very well taken, helping the individual parolee or ex-con reintegrate?
Well, I think there's two questions. One, whether or not the government should be able to do that. And I think that, you know, we live in a society where the government can deem to take your life legally. So I think obviously they have the ability to take your right to vote. As for whether or not it should be able to do that and whether or not it affects a disproportionately a larger group of people, I think that there's kind of a strange dichotomy where if it was something that was so important to people, to entire groups, then why would they do something that would put it at risk?
Well, we have the perfect two guests to address each of the points you raise, Alex, because I think we have one guest who deals with individual parolees and the reintegration question, and then we have one of the co-authors of the study, which and your study does go to the larger question of disenfranchisement. And I think the caller's point is well taken. There is the larger political question, and that's somewhat separate from the individual's need to become reintegrated in the society. And voting, I believe, is part of reintegration. But you're raising an even bigger question, aren't you? A larger political question of why we have a group of people disenfranchised for better than 140 years.
Right. No, that's absolutely right, Jamie. And look, this is an issue about democracy and not about politics. The foundation of our democracy is based on the right to vote. And people in our country have fought for many, many years in the courtrooms and on the streets to open up the franchise, right? Originally, it was limited, just as it was here in New York, to white propertied, wealthy white propertied men. But we have a long history of opening up the franchise to include women, to include African Americans, and that's really what is at the heart and the foundation of our democracy. So that's very much what this issue is. This is an issue is that all American citizens should have the right to vote.
And yet, Glenn, you might also take issue with Alex in his point that voting might not be at the top of his agenda if he we're looking at how to reintegrate a parolee. It sounds as though it is at the top of your agenda.
It absolutely is. Again, it's one of the questions we ask people as soon as they come through the door at the Fortune Society. And Bob may be surprised to find out that...
I think the caller was Alex.
Alex, I'm sorry. Alex may be surprised to find out that after people are involved in the criminal justice system, they're actually much more inclined to want to be involved in the political process after they get a sense of how the system itself impacts themselves and their communities. Mm. Anyone who walks into a prison here in New York State or in any state around this country gets an immediate understanding of who it is that's incarcerated in our prisons. And if you're a person of color and you walk into that setting and you notice that 80 to 85% of the people in the prison system are people from your community, you start getting a sense of the larger picture. Like, wait a minute, that means that the community I come from suffers from voter dilution. And no wonder we have potholes. No wonder we don't have services. No wonder I ended up here. And our clients end up more inclined to be involved in the political process.
I want to take a call from Juanita in the Bronx, who has a question about our topic. Juanita, you're on WMYC.
Yes. At one point, I worked as at Rikers Island, and I learned during a political campaign that the people being held were not able to vote. And I was really very surprised, and I wanted to find out how come, because they had not been actually charged. They were just being held. So they should have been able to vote, but they weren't.
So your question is whether people who are under arrest are able to vote?
That's right. I know if they are held at Rikers, they can't vote, and they should be able to vote.
Well, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I certainly should know the answer to that question, but I'm very happy Erica Wood is here because I know she has the right answer to your question rather than what I would cobble together for you. Erica?
Juanita, thanks for your question, and it raises a really important issue. You do not lose the right to vote in New York unless and until you are convicted of a felony. If you are convicted of a misdemeanor, you still have the right to vote. If you are a pretrial detainee, So you're being held at Rikers awaiting trial. You have not been convicted of anything. You still have the right to vote. If you are incarcerated at Rikers because of a misdemeanor conviction or a probation violation, you still have the right to vote. And we actually did a pilot project at Rikers Island this last summer, where we actually went in with our friends at the Bronx Defenders and did voter registration and helped people fill out absentee ballots. And I will say that the staff at Rikers was actually incredibly supportive of that effort. So there are people on Rikers who voted this last year.
So they are set up at Rikers because of your work and the work of Bronx Defenders to facilitate voting on the island for those who wish to vote.
That's right. Yep.
Wonderful. Now, we do have a call from Antonio in Queens who wants to speak to his personal experience with our topic. Antonio?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. When I was on parole, I actually went and voted. I didn't really care that they wanted to, you know, take away this right to vote. I went and voted. That was during the Bush. And I made a mistake with Bush. I really did. But I did with Obama. I was already out of parole, and I was very happy that I went with my son, and he seen me go through the whole processing thing. But to know, I don't know who the lady was who said, that 80% of the minorities are not allowed to vote in New York goes to show that there's a deeper problem. For example, I mean, every time for a reason, if I go to pay a traffic ticket or for some reason I end up in court, you see the overwhelming number of minorities, and, you know, it just sticks out like a sore thumb, you know? There are deeper and greater issues that I don't know.
I can't thank you enough, Antonio, for calling with your personal experience and your reaction to what you've heard on the program. I know that Erica wants to step in with one statistic.
Yeah, I just want to correct. Antonio, thank you again for your call, but it's 80% of those currently disenfranchised are Black and Latino. It's not 80% of Black and Latinos in New York. So just flip that.
That's what happens with statistics. It's so easy to misread and misquote them. Glenn, do you want to respond to what you heard Antonio say, though, about going in and voting anyway?
Only to say that I'm glad Antonio didn't give his last name. because I don't encourage people to vote when they actually are barred from voting under New York state law. But we do encourage people to register and vote as soon as they become eligible. When I got off parole, I remember registering to vote within days of getting off parole and unfortunately being told by the local boards of elections that I did not have the right to vote, even though I knew that under New York state law I did have the right to vote. And so that's another part of the problem, the misinformation, not just amongst our clients, but also amongst the officials who are in a position to enfranchise folks and help people to gain the right to vote. So, I mean, there's some states in the United States where you actually never get the right to vote returned to you. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, our clients hear that on the news and so on, and they assume that that's every state. And Because of that misinformation, they never even registered to vote, unfortunately.
I know in the election of 2000, that was a big issue in the state of Florida, misinformation about who could vote and who could not vote. And it may have had a direct impact on the result in that election. I know also, Erica Wood, that you and the Brennan Center are working on legislation to change the voting laws. I hope you'll come back and talk with Brian about your work in that area. We will have to leave it there for today. Erica Wood, author of the Brennan Center's report, Jim Crow in New York, and Glenn Martin for the Fortune Society. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Jamie.
This is Jamie Floyd filling in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC Radio. Up next, why we use salt to combat snow and its effect on your environment.